You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our studio guest is Claire McGlasson, here to talk about her debut novel, The Rapture. We'll also hear from Toby Litt talking about his new novel, Patience, and Erica Wickerson will explore the tropes of spy fiction and why it appeals to readers. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Claire. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But obviously, this is a radio studio. You're more used to a TV studio.
I am, yes. It's lovely to be. It's very cosy in here and warm.
It's cosy and warm. So you work for...
I work for ITV News. I'm based in Great Shelford at the Anglia office.
And your background is in journalism then?
Yes, I started in newspapers and magazines and then moved to TV probably about 15 years ago.
And still enjoy it very much, clearly.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I get to travel around East Anglia, and it's a privilege. You get to speak to people at the best of times and worst of times in their life and sort of help them to share their story. So it's great.
And in terms of making that shift from journalism to novel writing, when did you decide to do that?
I decided to do that when I came across the story that is in my first novel. I went to film at the Panacea Museum in Bedford for Anglia, and did a 3-minute piece for TV and loved so much about it. It didn't feel quite enough. So I tried to persuade various authors I'd spoke to along the way in the course of my job to write a book about this fantastic group of women. And James Runcie, who did the Grantchester Mysteries, we spent a lovely day together in Cambridge. And he said, well, why don't you write it? And I sort of went away and thought that was a ridiculous idea, but came around to thinking it might be quite a good one.
I'm so glad you did, Claire. I love this novel. I really can't wait to talk to you about it. But we'll listen to your first choice of music first, which is Camille O'Sullivan, The Ship Song. Why this one?
Well, a friend introduced me to this track. She'd seen Camille O'Sullivan at the Junction, I think, in Cambridge, and was just mesmerised by the way she performed every song. And when I listened to it, it just spoke to so many things that was in the novel as I was writing it, the atmosphere. So I listened to it quite a lot while I was writing, just to get me sort of in the zone, if you like.
Every time you come around,
that's The Ship Song by Camille O'Sullivan, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Claire McGlasson. Claire's debut novel, The Rapture, was published earlier this year. The Times called it intriguing, fascinating and impressive. The Daily Mail said, meticulously researched, this involving, moving and disturbing read throws light on a fascinating corner of history. Claire, I'd agree with all that, but one thing that I felt was missing from the reviews, and I wonder if this was me seeing things in it that weren't there, was the humour. There is humour in the book. I mean, it's black and it's bittersweet humour.
Yes.
But despite the darkness of the situation, there is a comic side to it. Was that there? Was that intentional?
I think more than intentional, it was unavoidable, really, because I researched in the archive of this real group of women, the Panacea Society, who began just in the 1920s in Bedford. And I read the missives that their leader, Octavia, was writing to instruct them on how to behave. And the humour was, as I say, unavoidable. You know, it was about the correct way to cut a jacket potato or the correct way to spread a napkin on your lap. And these very small domestic questions against this backdrop of, you know, religious fervour. And so I included some of those real excerpts in the novel in bold, just to bring people back to the fact that this was real. Because at times I thought people might not believe that this was really happening. And I wanted to sort of just nudge the reader that it was based on fact. And I had a great time. I mean, the biggest problem was leaving things out, because there was such a sort of rich vein to mine, really.
It's an extraordinary story. Tell us what the novel is about. It's set in that group, the Panacea Society, and it focuses on one particular member of the group.
Yes, so the Panacea Society began, as I say, in Bedford in the 1920s. I grew up nearby, not realising that this sort of terraces of Victorian houses, that behind them was the Garden of Eden, where these around 80 women were living together in a community. They knocked their garden walls down to live together. Hadn't realised they were there. Discovered that they were there. There's now a museum in the place where they lived. Went along for work, as I say, to do a piece for Anglia, and saw a photograph of a group of women taking tea and waiting patiently for Jesus in the garden. And they're all slightly blurred with the long exposure of the cameras back then, but there's one much younger woman looking directly down the lens at me, who's standing looking at the photograph. And I sort of got that chill and thought, who is that? And having looked into it, this was a character, well, a person, she becomes a character in my book, but a person called Dillis, who was much younger. And it's her story of being within the community, and then someone joins from the outside, the only wholly invented character in the novel, of someone called Grace, who joins as an outsider. And it's her viewpoint from the outside and their growing friendship, which causes Dillis to look again at where she is and why.
And the cult, it is a cult, isn't it? The cult is led by Octavia.
Yes.
Dillis's mother, who is an extraordinary character. And as you say, you've included missives and memos from her in bold. I mean, she's quite something, isn't she?
Yes, one of my favourite reviews likened her to a cross between Hyacinth Bouquet and Rosemary's Baby. So there is that sort of, on the one hand, you know, comedy, but on the other hand, it's very dark. There's a lot about mental health in the book and how that can both explain religious experience, but also how mental health and problems can be exacerbated by this belief as well. And what struck me most about her was that we tend to think of cult leaders as being older men who were deliberately exploiting younger women, usually. This was a woman called Mabel. She was a vicar's wife, had led a perfectly ordinary life, but was told by these followers that she was the daughter of God. And that took, you know, it took its toll on her health. I have no doubt she loved bossing people around, but it also took an incredible toll on her.
And changed her name to Octavia.
Yes. The eighth prophet.
The eighth prophet. At what stage did you think this is a story? I mean, you came across it in terms of your reporting. At what stage did you think, you know, I can take this, there's a kernel of something here, and build a fictional world or a fictional character into it?
I think straight away. I just didn't know if I was the person to write it. I'm used to doing very short scripts for TV. You know, pack a story into 3 minutes and hopefully pique people's interest. I think the biggest problem was that there was 100 years of history. The last member only died, incredibly, in 2014. 2012. I came to the story in 2014. So it was more a case of how can I make it manageable and make it into a novel that's readable. And what I did with that was to condense time into the space of a year. So I took some events that happened slightly before and slightly later, but also in terms of the number of characters, because there were 80 women living in close quarters. So I took some of their experiences from diaries and confessions and letters, and I condensed them into a smaller number of characters.
And a lot of research there. You're able, the Panacea Society had kept a lot. And did you also do research into cults as well, separately?
I did do some research into cults, and also I did quite a lot of reading into medieval nuns. And what it was like to live in that sort of close proximity and to have that degree of belief, because we read them from a modern viewpoint now, and a nun's experience of her relationship with God is a very physical, very present thing, almost a romantic relationship in the way it's described. And I was really fascinated by this idea of the rapture of religious fervour, but also the rapture of falling in love, and how the two might be confused, really.
And we, because you call her Octavia very early on, you give the pronouns she and he, her, have a capital.
Yes.
Capital S, capital H. It's almost like we're in the cult from the beginning, which I really enjoyed. Was that your intention?
Yes, I think I think from Dilys's point of view, at that point, Octavia is, in her belief, the daughter of God. And so the way that we do, the way that would be the convention with Jesus or God, to have the capital letter, it just constantly reminds you that it's not just another character. Because at times she does behave in ways which, you know, as a modern reader and as someone without that belief, you could easily be swayed by that. It's very human behaviour.
Are there descendants of these women still alive?
There are a few. A lot of them were, what that terrible term, spinsters. Some of them did have children, and there are a few, but no one living nearby, no one that I've met. Or,
and we're talking about women. There were some men in there, and they didn't particularly come to a good end.
No,
but there were two men, and so the two male characters in there, they're real as well.
Yes, there are three in the book. They're real. They don't necessarily get the best experience in there, but that was based on fact. So as much as possible, things that happen in the book, sort of key events, and the general strike being one of them, are based on facts. And they are men who, I mean, you'd have to question why they would join a cult of women at an age where, as a man, they have a lot more power and control of their own lives. These were men who joined because they were seeking shelter from the outside world, I think. May not have fared too well in the outside world, so they join this cult of women and follow a female leader.
And as you say, you put real things in bold in the book. At what stage did you make that decision? It's quite a gamble, really, isn't it? Because it could take the reader out of the moment. Mm. It doesn't, actually. It just reinforces how weird and kind of strangely wonderful but weird this world is. But what stage did you decide to do that?
I think, again, probably from the beginning, I was hoping to do that. I mean, there's so much more in the body of the novel that's based on fact. But I also wanted to be clear that this is my imagined version of their story. There's been a non-fiction book written about them already. There's a museum that sort of remembers them. But this is all told through the lens of my impression of them. So I read widely in the Panacea archives, which is huge. It's shopping lists, it's you know, receipts for coal being delivered, it's confessions, some of which were unsealed. I was given a letter opener. Wow. Which features in the novel and opening these letters that had never been opened before. But I wanted to be clear that this is not the version of events, this is my imagined version. And I have taken liberties. So.
And the picture on the hardback,
yes,
the front cover of the hardback, is Dilys's bedroom.
Yes.
That's kind of spooky, looking at that when you've been reading about the character. It's absolutely fascinating. We'll come back and talk to you more about the rapture, Claire. Let's hear from Toby Litt now. Toby is a novelist, memoirist, essayist and short story writer. He's a Granter Best of Young British Novelists. His short story collection, Lifelike, published in 2015, was shortlisted for the Edgehill Short Story Prize and longlisted for the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. Famed for writing his books in alphabetical order, beginning with Adventures in Capitalism, starting with an A, obviously, published in 1996, his latest novel, Patience, came out this year. Set in an orphanage in 1979 and narrated by Elliot, a boy with cerebral palsy, unable to speak and barely able to move, The Guardian described it as a very beautiful book which deserves to be widely read. I met Toby to talk about Patience, but I couldn't resist starting the interview by asking him if he'd ever regretted that commitment to writing his novels in alphabetical order.
I haven't regretted it more than I've benefited from it, but there are some tricky letters. I'm on Q at the moment, and that's a slightly tricky one. Thinking about whether to use T as the, which would mean I could push something in there that I wouldn't able to use otherwise, in other words, a letter from earlier in the alphabet. But no, because it allows me to structure my future, which most people can't do. So I can sort of dream of, oh, there'll be something called V someday. What'll that be? I think that's a good thing.
Do you write the novel and then think of the title, or do you think of the title and then think, I'll write a novel around this issue?
A mix of both. I mean, some of the books have come out of the letter almost. And in fact, Kieran Carson, the Belfast poet, I always think of him when I think of hospital, because for me, hospital sort of came out of the H sign that you see when you drive anywhere. And I thought, what's the most sort of H thing? And I set it in an H-shaped building, and I had lots of things like that. And I did a reading from it when I was in Belfast, and Kieran was sitting in the front row. And I was saying this, I was saying, look, hospital is sort of H. H is hospital. When you think of H, you think of hospital. He said, no. Think of the H blocks. I said, come on, but really, you really, H is more essential. No, I think of the H blocks. Okay, fine, I'm in Belfast. That's what you think of. So sometimes it comes that way. With I play the drums in a band called OK. There's a Japanese genre, which I don't know a huge amount about, but I heard of it, which is the I novel. So I sort of thought, well, it's an I book, so maybe it should be an I novel in that, a first-person novel or a first-person thing. But a lot of the time it's more the people in the book now, and that's certainly true with Patience. It was the people in the book rather than wanting to write something starting with P.
So let's talk about Patience then. So Elliot in Patience, he's an extraordinary character. Where did he come from?
He is a character who has cerebral palsy. He can't move. And for a long time I've written about characters who in some way or other are paralysed. Either they can't act, or in some way they get imprisoned or stuck. So in one way he's the fulfilment of that. But in a very abrupt way, I saw a photograph in an exhibition when I was in Leipzig, I think 13 years ago, taken by a photographer in a children's hospital, and one of the boys there was sitting in a wheelchair looking out of a large glass window in a sort of modern building towards the viewer, towards the camera, and had an incredibly intense gaze and was obviously full of thought about what was going on. You could sort of tell that, and another of the photographs, the photographer was called Tim Rautert, they sort of combined, and I started thinking of writing a story, just a short story, with that boy at the centre of it. But then it, over a long, long period of time, 12 years, it turned into a novel.
And how did you find his voice? Because he speaks in a very particular way.
The voice took a long time to come, partly because he's much more nice and gracious than I am. And I realised that he swerved towards appreciating things. And the sentences that I used had to stopping. And people have noticed there isn't a lot of punctuation, but the voice actually became his when I allowed it to go on beyond where it would normally stop, or where I would normally stop with a sentence, and take more in and be more fluid and exploratory with the world. He wants to take as much of the world in as he can, because it's very limited what he's allowed to see, and so he grasps at things. But he also uses language really to dance, essentially. He wants to play with those rhythms, so he's composing sentences or playing with words in his head. And he doesn't want some sort of sentence that has a very jerky rhythm. He wants something that is elegant. So that's where it came from. It was his aspiration, and also just love of language, love of words, and the words that you can pick up. And mainly he picks up his words from listening to Radio 3.
It's asking something of the reader, isn't it, to stick with that and to find sense within what are quite long sentences sometimes.
Yeah, but I think it starts, the first sentence is, please have patience with me, and the reader who wants to get to things immediately is going to probably take that as fair warning. Within the sentences, though, there are meant to be gifts. It's meant to be full of things that you appreciate or that you see through his eyes. You're meant to settle into accepting that this is going to be tense because you want things to happen, you want things to move along, but actually you're just going to have to pay attention in the way he does. And that if the sentences were handing over those gifts too fast, it would be like getting your Christmas presents early, which is always disappointing.
And it's set in 1979. Why that year?
For me, it's a sort of tipping point in my life, in political life, but also it's a time when someone like Eliot with cerebral palsy would not have been given the chances that hopefully he will be given now. He would have been written off as someone who really couldn't be educated, who wasn't going to have capacity to learn. There wouldn't have been technology for him to communicate. If I'd set the story in a contemporary children's home, he would have been almost unusually punished for his situation, for having cerebral palsy. It would have been an extremely bad children's home, where it's not meant to be extremely bad. It's meant to be muddling along, doing its best with not many staff. But as far as 1979, it's sort of got to have a sense that there's stuff going on outside that people immediately know about. They know Margaret Thatcher's elected. They know that it's the possible beginning of the 80s and all that sort of stuff, that slightly brightening of the world. And he's missing that.
And writing from the point of view of a person with cerebral palsy, very brave thing to do. You must have been aware of all the sensitivities and possible accusations that could be levelled at you.
Yes, I was. And so I thought I just have to not do this. For years, I thought, you know, don't do this. But the voice became very strong in my head. And I wanted to write something that wasn't about him having cerebral palsy. It was about his point of view on the world. His point of view is one that has been formed by him not being able to pick things up or to force himself upon things. And he's become very observant and very clever, really, through force of that. And so in order to justify that to myself, I was reading biographies and autobiographies, and particularly Christy Nolan's Under the Eye of the Clock. Subsequently, a few readers have read it and they've been sending me things about people with cerebral palsy, one of whom did a OU degree, got a PhD, a philosophy PhD, and he typed his thesis with one finger. So I'm hoping that I haven't messed that up. The defence is I've done it as well as I possibly could, and I've tried to take in the written stuff that was out there.
And The Guardian said of it, this is a very beautiful book that deserves to be read. You must have been delighted with that.
Yes. I mean, they've been just about the best reviews I've ever had. But then I hoped that I'd written the best book I'd written. So if the response had been that this is boring or this is unreadable or something, I'd have thought, oh, I was really deluded for about 3 years, because I enjoyed writing it and I sort of delighted in the company I was with. And I miss Eliot as a narrator. I've got other narrators now and they're not letting me play as much. They don't dance as much. They're galumphing around. So I'm just very glad.
Do the reviews still matter? Do you read reviews? Do you seek them out?
Well, I never used to. That's the thing. I do now. Because I feel, partly because I'm published by Galley Beggar, they're very delighted when something good happens, when a good review comes in, and they send me a delighted email. And so I want to see what they're happy about. Overall, the idea of obsessing about reviews is something I've always tried to distance myself from, because you either go around with a swelled head or you don't want to write anything at all, and neither of those things are good. So I just grateful that people like Eliot as much as I do.
And is this the second book you've published with Galley Beggar?
Yes.
And they're a small press that I think we'd agree punch way above their weight. What's it been like working with them?
They are very involved and they're very passionate and they're great readers. This is Sam and Ellie, the two people that run it. They're based in Norwich. And it feels like you're engaged in something together, and the other authors there are very supportive they will come along to your launch, they will send you emails. And so we're sort of in it together, which is a good feeling.
And what's next for you? I say what's next for you. Presumably it's Q.
It is Q.
Have you been dreading Q?
No, I've actually been looking forward to it. But for quite some time, I thought it would be about some sort of foppish character called Quentin or something like that. I'm very cagey about what I'm writing, so no one knows. Currently, I'm on the dark side of the moon, lost all contact with Earth. It will come along when it comes along, but it possibly will change what it is completely before it arrives.
And Patience by Toby Litt is published by Gallybeggar Press. We're here today as talking to studio guest on Bookmark, Claire McGlasson, talking about her debut novel, The Rapture. Claire, The Rapture set in Bedford,
yes.
An unlikely place for a cult, I think we can all agree.
Yes.
That. But it was more than just one house, wasn't it? It was a community. Did they buy the houses so they linked up? And then
they did, yeah. They moved next to each other wherever possible and then knocked the garden walls down. So in the back was what they came to believe the original Garden of Eden, where they would live as a community. And the problem was the leader, Octavia, was telling them that they had to be, you know, faultless, colourless, zero. They were preparing for Jesus to come back, and they had to be, quiet, and they had to not put their personality out too much. But when you're a group of mainly women, I mean, anyone living together in close quarters, that's the time that those differences in personality traits will become glaringly obvious, I think, when you're living in such close quarters.
And listening to it now, you know, sitting here, well, I am sniggering a shit. Mm. Did you get any sense of why the women themselves who were members went along with it? Were they all looking for something? Were they damaged in some way, or did they genuinely believe this?
I think in some ways it was a perfect storm. They'd lost, I mean, anyone in that generation had experienced the horror in some form of World War One. Many of them had lost, you know, sons, or that generation of women had lost husbands, they'd lost brothers, some of them. And they came to believe that men had made rather a mess of things. Some of them were former suffragettes as well. And they believed that, I mean, the crux of their belief was that, you know, the church was telling them that Jesus would save their eternal soul, and that there was happiness coming. But they were questioning, well, why are we suffering now? How can a just God? And this is, you know, constantly a question in Christianity, isn't it? Of how can God allow us to suffer on this scale now? And they came to believe that woman was the answer to that. Eve had caused the fall. It was up to woman to heal that rift. And I think, you know, on the face of it, it was quite an attractive proposition. They were making a difference. They were very efficient. They had their own printing press, translators, people sending healing all over the world. They were able to make a difference on their terms. And they had the money to buy these properties and live independently without marriage or without men telling them what to do. So I can understand why it was attractive. And it started, as cults tend to do, as being a safe and a very positive experience. But when there's that element of control, think of it a little bit like a coercive control in a relationship. You know, it can start off as being very exciting and seeming to be very caring and supportive. But then when the control sets in and you're made to feel less than you are, and you're made to feel that the faults lie with you, it then becomes very difficult to leave that.
Well, let's leave that for just a moment and listen to your second choice of music now, which is Dolly Parton and Bargain Store.
Yeah.
Is great. This, why this one?
I love Dolly Parton. I mean, I think, you know, the image is one thing and you can't help but smile, but I think she's an exceptional songwriter, and I love the way she's turned this common idea of women as being sort of soiled goods if they've been in a relationship before, and she turns it on its head and absolutely takes control back.
Like unto a bargain store, and I may have just what you're looking for. If you don't mind the fact that all the merchandise is used, but with a little mending it could be as good as new.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books,
And we're talking to Claire McGlasson today on Bookmark about her debut novel, The Rapture. Claire, you're saying that it's based on a lot of research, the Panacea Society, kept files. The truth is stranger than fiction, they say. You must have thought that many, many times when you were going through this.
Yes, and there are lots of things I found in the archive that didn't make it into the book.
Yes, was there something that you thought this people just wouldn't buy it if I put it in the novel?
I did find a letter when I was most of the way through, which suggested that the main character, Dillis, had a revolver, which she kept under her bed. I was very clear from the beginning. I didn't want this just to be a backdrop for sort of a murder mystery that I artificially pasted on from the outside. So everything's grown from something I read or something I felt about what I'd read. But yes, you can find a nugget like that and think you sort of re-question everything that you're writing. But I sort of look at it as a bit like a target with target practice. You'll get lots of things that clump around the middle that seem to make sense with each other. And then you get these outlying things, which might be very, very exciting in themselves. And the temptation might be to put them in because it's, quite an exciting nugget of something. But I felt that I had to stick to that central area, really. These women were ridiculed in life, dismissed ever since. And in some ways they are, quite easily the punchline of a joke, a Garden of Eden in Bedford. But I wanted to try and understand them as real people and have some sympathy with why they're there and what they might be experiencing. It's sort of the gaps between the facts are much more interesting than the facts themselves.
Oh, I think that comes across. Even the healing, which I'll ask you to talk about, the healing fabric, which, it's hard for a reader to go along with, if not impossible to believe that it was healing. But they did, and they wanted to do good with it, didn't they? They wanted to heal people and places.
Yes, and they, so just to explain what it was, they believed that Octavia had the power to heal in her breath. And because they were very efficient, if nothing else, they decided that a good way of posting that out across the world was to get her to breathe on these great rolls of linen and then cut them into 1-inch square, which was the size of a miracle. And they posted them out to conservative estimates around 130,000 people worldwide. And the only thing that people had to do was say what their complaint was and whether it had worked. There was no money. They weren't out to benefit from this. A lot of the letters I wrote from people writing in for healing were what they describe as problems with their nerves after the war. But it could have been anything. It could be chilblains, which feature in the book, where you would dab this bit of cloth on, or you might drink water that the piece of linen had sort of swelled around in. And a lot of people thought it worked. And I think if you're suffering, particularly with mental ill health at that time, why not try it? They may have been writing to a dozen healers across the world, maybe not just Octavia, but they certainly, some of them thought it helped. So, I thought later maybe the placebo society rather than panacea because, for some people it did work. And that's fascinating in itself, to see what effect that belief can have on your health.
And they pinned their hopes of a revelation, if you like, on this box.
Yes.
This really existed, this box.
It really exists.
It still exists.
The box still exists.
Tell us about the box.
So they came to believe that Octavia was the Messiah that they'd been waiting for. They'd been waiting for a male Messiah, and then they came to believe that actually it would be a woman all along. And a prophetess called Joanna Southcott, who'd lived 100 years before, very, very famous in her day, cartoons of her in all the papers. She believed she was pregnant in her 60s with the next Messiah. She died without having produced this child. And they came to believe that Octavia was this saviour. Joanna Southcott had sealed up a number of prophecies in a box, which would only be opened in a time of great national distress. And there were many reasons given why it would be in the 20s, particularly the war having happened. Also jazz, the rise of jazz, lots of things happening that were terribly dangerous. Someone said to me recently, arguably it could be now, but we won't mention the B word on the radio. So they believed that they would have to get the bishops of the Church of England to open this box in accordance with Joanna Southcott's instructions. So they devoted their life to try and persuade the male bishops to come. They had a house waiting for them, all laid out. They had dress rehearsals on how they would serve them dinner and put them all up for the night. And that became the thing they devoted their lives to. But the box still exists, but it hasn't been opened because there are some people who still believe in Joanna Southcott's prophecies.
Absolutely fascinating. And one of the things you do very well, I think, in the book is this sense of paranoia that the group has. I suppose any cult would have. It's it's us against them. And that was that evident in the things that you read?
I think us against them also, the line comes back a little because they're being spied on, they're encouraged to spy on each other. So they had to report on each other's sins and failings for their own good, to help them to become this colourless, faultless, zero person. So within this close community, they are encouraged to spy on each other, to report on each other. And so even within the safety of that community, there's paranoia, because wherever you turn, you're being watched.
Well, thank you, Claire. You've led me very nicely into our second interview, which is about spy fiction. Erica Wickerson is a research fellow at St John's College, Cambridge. She won a British Academy Rising Star Engagement Award for her work on borders and crossings. Her first book, The Architecture of Narrative Time, was shortlisted for the Waterloo Centre for German Studies Prize, and she's written widely on German and English literature. Last month, she spoke about another of her passions, spy fiction, at the Festival of Ideas organised by Cambridge University. I chatted to her ahead of her talk, Spies and Assassins in Fiction Through the Ages, and asked her how she defined spy fiction.
Well, spy fiction, I'd say, is a subset of the thriller genre, and also it often starts as a kind of whodunit. So in a lot of notable spy stories, it might open with some kind of assassination or explosion or terrorist attack. And so it would then operate in the form of a whodunit by the protagonists moving backwards in time, piecing together what has happened. But the thriller basically does the opposite. It's all about kind of exciting events to come, what's going to happen next. So in this sense, spy fiction is a mixture of the whodunit and the thriller. But the main distinction really is the big political games going on, the tales of espionage, the deception, the disguises, the international plots.
Because it's politically based, does it change over the years? Or did it change post-Glasnost, for example?
Yes, it certainly does change over the years. So, for example, in a lot of older James Bonds, you'll have contemporary politics. John le Carré often focuses his novels around contemporary international politics, so the Cold War or battle between East and West, capitalism and communism. But one thing that's quite interesting in trends in spy fiction today is how actually they're avoiding political allegiances, or even, for example, explicitly mentioning national allegiances. So if you think of Killing Eve, we don't actually know whose side Villanelle is on, who she's working for. So she's Russian, but she's rejected her Russian heritage. She refuses to speak Russian. She lives in Paris. She works for a mysterious international organisation. And I do wonder if this is actually a deliberate decision to avoid inflaming any real-life politics.
And you talk a lot about Killing Eve, the TV show. It's obviously very groundbreaking in this genre.
It is. This is a really interesting question because it certainly does seem to be very different from, for example, James Bond. But in many ways, it's also not that groundbreaking. So we think of it as very modern. Most of the protagonists are really strong, empowering female figures, for example. It's not the traditional games between men. But also it plays on lots of tropes that go back over basically the last century. So Killing Eve is what I would call an example of the seesaw model of spy fiction. We see this actually in Joseph Conrad's very early exemplar of spy fiction, The Secret Agent, and also John le Carré's The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. And what's distinct about this model is how it's not simply about the tale of political intrigue or the games between men, but also you have this secondary story, which in all cases becomes basically the main story, which is about personal relationships. And so Killing Eve, yes, it's distinct in making these relationships fundamentally between women, but it's also playing on much older tropes in the genre.
But it is very female-based, yeah. Isn't it? Obviously, it's about the relationship between two women. I think when most people think of spy fiction, they think of men huddled in corners in Homburg hats and big overcoats.
Yes, indeed, yeah. James Bond's there is also not distinct. So John Buchan, 39 Steps, and Erskine Childers, The Riddle of the Sands, which, again, early 20th century. They also have old Etonians or Oxbridge-educated young men of means who have no family ties, thus no vulnerabilities. So these kind of traditional straight white men hero types who are just simplistically vanquishing the monster. Whereas in Killing Eve, it's made a lot more complex and I think a lot more interesting and a lot subtler because of the relationships between women. And not just women. I mean, if you think about Eve's husband, her marriage. This is also a really interesting sub-story which affects how she operates professionally as well.
And Killing Eve, based on a novel by Luke Jennings, is spy fiction different on the screen than it is on the page?
Yes, of course, on screen, both in film and television, you have the possibilities for sight and sound as well, so it's not purely evoked through language. Spy fiction, the focus on space and setting is really important because it's all about borders, boundaries, who can blend into certain spaces, who can cross borders and boundaries. And so it's really interesting how different forms of narrative actually evoke a sense of space and setting and also sound. So Killing Eve, a lot of people talk about the costumes, for example, these settings. This is a traditional trope in the spy genre that you have these kind of scenic settings. But also it's really interesting, or it's one of the things that gives it this kind of novel sensation, is the music. And TV, I'd say, is actually also different from film in that TV is episodic. We have short, maybe hour-long episodes. The viewers need to be gripped sufficiently to move on to the next episode, not just in terms of binge-watching on Netflix, but actually tuning in the following week. Whereas with James Bond films, for example, you just need to sit for an hour and a half in the cinema. So it's a very different sense of time and a very different sense of space.
And how important is the plot in all of this? We've talked about location and characters. Often the plot can be extremely confusing, and that's not what many people remember from James Bond.
Plots, I find personally in spy fiction, they're often really hard to follow. You don't necessarily know who's on which side and so on. And also they often seem quite like a game of chess, so simply pawns being moved around a board, basically. But the plot is important. In this traditional model of spy fiction, the male action model, as I term it, you basically get a sort of single narrative drive where the overall question that the reader or the viewer really wants answering is, will the hero win? Will the goodies vanquish the baddies? So this goes back to traditional tales of myth and so on that we've been reading or hearing about for millennia. Whereas in the seesaw model, you have these intertwined plots, basically the main plot of will the heroes win, but then you also have this more intricate, what will happen with the personal relationships, who loves whom, who hates, you know, which other characters and so on, and what will go on there. And these plots actually often become subtly intertwined, and that actually complicates the overall story as well.
You talked about the good guy and the bad guy there. How important are morals and having a moralistic ending to spy fiction?
Traditionally, I think spy fiction has rested a lot on the notion of morality and prioritising a particular sort of moral perspective. Earlier I mentioned the idea that the hero in the male action model, Bond, Erskine Childers, John Buchan and so on, is this Oxbridge-educated rich white man. But basically, often there, you have one perspective prioritised, and that's the goodies, traditionally the British. And if you do go into the perspective of the baddies, the foreign power, for example, in Ian Fleming's novels, it's only to show how unremittingly bad they are, how evil, how disturbed they are, sadistic. They'll always have a physical flaw to exemplify their evilness. Whereas in this sort of seesaw model, this more complex version with the double story going on, you don't have such a simplistic sense of morality. Killing Eve is a great example. We basically are led to like both Villanelle and Eve, and we see things from both of their perspectives. And this is also true of Joseph Conrad and John le Carré.
And you've compared spy fiction to Winnie the Pooh.
Yes.
Explain.
My thinking there is Winnie the Pooh, and there are many examples of this found in children's literature, it's basically a particular type of character where we can identify with the character. We can see ourselves in them. That's what makes them so appealing. They're likeable, but they're fundamentally flawed. So we see this in Disney films all the time, lots of traditional children's literature. And the plot that happens there is that we're introduced to the character, we're invited to sympathise with them, we see their faults, then something happens to change their everyday existence and they go on an adventure and develop and find themselves. And basically I'd say that Eve, Pilastri in Killing Eve, or indeed Alec in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, or Mr. Verloc or his wife Winnie Verloc in The Secret Agent, they all effectively, in the model of Winnie the Pooh, they're all likeable in some sense, but also fundamentally flawed, and that's what draws us in.
And is that why spy fiction's so popular, do you think? Because we can at least partly identify with the hero.
I think that's why one brand of spy fiction is so popular, that we can see ourselves in them and we can go on an adventure with a character with whom we identify. The other, more traditional brand of spy fiction is so popular because it does just the opposite. It's a fantasy, it's an escapist world, particularly if you are already a heterosexual white man, so less so for the rest of us. But you can there see yourself in this kind of adventurous situation with fast cars, gadgets, women. Both models of spy fiction do provide us with something exciting, and the best, I'd say, actually fine balance in between those.
And what is it about spy fiction that appeals to you?
It's inherently appealing. I think that mixture, for me particularly in these double story works, of the big political plots, whether or not you understand them, and also the intricate personal stories, I think that's inherently exciting. I think the notions of disguises, deception, double crossings, you don't know where people's loyalties are, you don't know what's going to happen. And this very appealing idea of being able to become different people. I mean, the notion of the spy as someone who can blend in chameleon-like to other surroundings, that's inherently exciting, I'd say. How stories are constructed and why they're so appealing, why they entertain us.
And what is your favourite spy novel?
It's a really hard question. I think when I read The Spy Who Came In From the Cold for the first time, I was gripped, and I was almost surprised at how gripping I found it, because I knew it was a bit of a classic and I thought it might take a bit more work. Joseph Conrad's The Secret Agent I found much harder to read initially. It took a lot longer to get into, but basically it left me with a lot more in a way. So I found it really thought-provoking. I think it has one of the most complex and interesting characters in spy fiction, who isn't the secret agent, but the secret agent's wife. Joseph Conrad does incredible things with language, which, yes, take a bit more work, but are rewarding.
And that was Erica Wickerson talking about spy fiction. We've been talking today to Claire McGlasson about her debut novel, The Rapture. Sadly, Claire, I could talk to you about this novel endlessly. We are coming to the end of our time with you. What's been the reaction to the publication of this novel?
Do you mean sort of reviews-wise or friends and family? Or?
Well, just the wider world suddenly knowing about this, the Panacea Society.
Yeah, I mean, most people have said, how did I not know, particularly people who live in the area, how did I not know it was there? And a lot of people, it's funny, isn't it? When they read, they're all casting who they would want to play. Octavia reminded me of such and such. Also, lots of people come up and say that. And I have had various people who've come up and said, I had an aunt that lived either while it was still a religious society, or the houses were rented out. Because as each member would die, they believed they were going to come back. So they would seal off the houses and mothball them, a lot of them with all their things still in. But some of them, as the years went on, were sort of tidied out and rented out to people in Bedford. So a lot of people were living in these houses in the Garden of Eden and hadn't realised.
Wow.
And so I do get people coming forward with lots of stories, which are great.
And what next for you? What are you doing at the moment?
Well, I'm still working for ITV News, so that's 3 days a week. And then the other 2 days a week, I sit and write. I force myself to sit and write, even on those days where the words aren't flowing so well. And some days when they are, and I'm thoroughly, you know, in my element. So I've started work on a second novel, which what I'm working on at the moment, it's another case of fact being stranger than fiction. That's all I'll probably say at this
yes,
point.
Yes, understandably.
Dark Side of the Moon, as Toby Litt said there.
And what are you reading at the moment? This question we ask all our guests.
I have just treated myself to Margaret Atwood, The Testaments, because I've been reading a lot of books for research for this new idea I'm working on. And any Atwood book, I've been a lifelong fan. I wrote my dissertation on her.
Right.
She's the reason I studied English at university, actually. So I've been saving that as a treat to myself after working through various research books.
I will enjoy. We'll come to your last choice of music in just a moment, but a heads up on the next show. Our studio guest is Ziba Tarkhani, talking about her memoir, My Past is a Foreign Country, subtitled A Muslim Feminist Finds Herself. We'll also hear from James Riley on his book, The Bad Trip, an examination of the dark side of 1960s counterculture. And Amelia Gentleman talks about the Windrush betrayal, exposing the hostile environment, her uncovering of the scandalous treatment meted out by the Home Office to the descendants of the Windrush generation. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Claire, which is very upbeat, S Club 7 and Reach. Why this one?
This was the song that was playing when my agent phoned to tell me that Faber and Faber had had offered to publish my novel. My children had been dancing to it at the school disco, and I was dancing around the kitchen cooking dinner when the call came.
Cambridge 105 Radio.